It is impossible to talk with somebody who's in jail.
White groups insist Egypt's jails are filled with political dissidents.
The Egyptian government is just afraid of any discordant voice.
سادساً إعادة تفعيل عمل لجنة العفو الرئاسي. إن الوطن يتسع لنا جميعاً وإن الاختلاف في الرأي لا يفسد للوطن قضية. لا يفسد للوطن قضية.
Don't you see that the whole aim of TeamSpeak is to narrow the range of thought? In the end, we shall make thought crime literally impossible, because there will be no words in which to express it. George Orwell. Welcome to episode 21 of the Tahi podcast. Today's episode is the first of its kind, since it's going to be like a commentary slash analysis kind of episode. Where Ahmed and I, Ahmed's a great friend, my smarter friend, where we'll be looking at the, quote, national dialogue proposed by Egypt's interim president last May. And that quote was just in case the episode turns out to be shitty, so you have the... Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me again. You really don't do yourself many favors, but thank you for calling me smart, I guess. I have to say, though, my head's completely empty. Way too much to do lately, but I think this dialogue will be interesting to talk about, especially after it actually happens. This is more of a preview sort of thing, and I think we should be back after it actually goes down.
Well, actually, like, first hearing of this whole national dialogue thing, even a couple of days after the president called for it, I think around two or three people were arrested for criticizing the call for national dialogue, which I think was kind of absurd. And I think looking at like the whole thing from afar, why do you even need a national dialogue in the first place? Your constitution guarantees dignity. Article 52 addresses torture. Article 54, personal freedom. Article 65, freedom of thought, freedom of research, and so forth. So I think if you really want, quote, dialogue, just activate the constitution that already guarantees all of these freedoms and all of these political and press rights, and release non-combatants and stop persecuting non-combatants by the SSP. So what do you think, why did he call for that rather than just activate the constitution?
Well, one thing that you want is already happening, because the state security courts can't take any extra cases. The weird thing is that they're still ongoing, like the ones that are ongoing haven't ended. But you mentioned that some people got arrested. The funny thing is, on the same day, people who criticized news similar to it when the reactivation of the pardon committee happened, were released because there was nothing to charge them with, because the emergency law's gone. They still arrest people for the emergency law, but then they can't charge them. And I think this is mostly why it's happening, if I had to guess. The state is in a sort of weird position where it doesn't know where to go next. Most of what they wanted to achieve when it came to the security state was already achieved. Most of the enemies are gone. Like, for better or for worse, they're mostly gone. So what now? And I don't think it's a dialogue for us, like as people or as anyone to do with journalism or anything other than the big journalistic institutions. I think it's a dialogue between parties and between unions and some of the bigger NGOs of where do we go from here? If you're a party like the Dignity Party or the Nasserists, if you're not in parliament, what do you do? There was a proposal a few months ago, I think it was WEV who proposed it, where they wanted to ban every party that wasn't in parliament so that they could make the parties in parliament stronger. And obviously something like that wouldn't fly with parties like that, and generally wouldn't be very fair. It's more or less saying, I got mine, fuck you. So I think it's more where do we go from here as institutional actors, especially the parties that aren't already figures there. Like, well, they did a whole 180 after their party election, and now one of their main platforms for the dialogue is to have a shadow cabinet. Something like that, for example, would be a new thing for us to have, right? It would bring a new dynamic. Or it could just be more positions for party elites to be in, if they can't agree on how to make it function. Or if it's just a hodgepodge of all the opposition parties.
Yeah, but also there's this, I don't know why there's this tendency to overcomplicate stuff and, you know, say national dialogue and the presidential pardon committee and this, which I think is, I mean, it's nice to a certain extent, but to a certain extent, it's also bullshit. Because why not save yourself the money and the work and the energy and just activate the constitution that already guarantees all of these freedoms and release and stop persecuting non-combatants before the SSP. I think that sounds like a more doable and more realistic and a more and easier solution. So what do you think?
I think it's, well, for one thing, they have a thing for bureaucracy. I don't know if you saw a few days ago, they finally issued a permit for the nuclear power plant as a power plant. Like, why does that need a permit? I think we already knew, given that they zoned an entire city around it, that it was already legal. But they just really love bureaucratization. I think it's the sort of state-level neurosis that we've always had, going back to after the revolution in the 50s, where we have to institutionalize everything because we feel really insecure about the state and its longevity, right? Like, I don't think we've ever recovered from 1967, to be honest. We've always been in a sort of state of, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So everything has to be impersonal and everything has to be a bureaucratized institution that may outlive us, even if it relies on like one or two people to function. And it's the same thing with activating the constitution. Most of it is already active, but there are laws that contradict it that are also still active, because they haven't gotten around to changing them for any reason. Like the local government bill that's now 3-4 years late. It's these kind of contradictions that I think they want to resolve, ideally, with the dialogue. But I told you this before the show, honestly, I don't think the dialogue can go anything other than one of two ways, where either this is going to be a watershed moment and these 500 to 1,000 people are going to decide the next 10 years, or it's going to be like a complete nothing. It's just going to be like that Mosfilyom economic conference, but just on a bigger scale. They're just going to talk about numbers, maybe bullshit about the budget a little bit. Maybe a few people will grandstand and get standing ovations or whatever, but otherwise nothing will happen. Like, it's either going to be absolutely nothing and we won't even bother making a follow-up episode, or it's going to be like earth-shattering news.
But what do you think would make what do you think would make this quote dialogue worth it? Because when I thought about it, I thought, why not release all non-combatants? I realize I've been saying non-combatants for a while now. So first of all, I think the 60,000 political prisoners is bullshit. I think there are thousands, but I don't think it's 60,000. So why not release those? Go ahead.
I was, for a paper I've been writing, it might get published soon. I won't mention the co-author because I'm not sure if he condones podcasts, that we've been writing it about political freedoms. We tried to narrow down the number of political prisoners, and the Ministry of Interior says there are between 10,000 and 15,000, depending on how you define it, which sounds about right, I guess. Depending on how you define it part is tricky, though. Because if you say that everyone who was arrested for being part of the Brotherhood is a political prisoner, then you could get to like 40, 50,000. But, you know, you'd have to ignore car bombs. It's also a stretch to say 60,000 when there are only 140,000 prisoners total. Like, if almost half the prisoners are political prisoners, then holy shit, we commit no crimes. It's the most peaceful nation on the planet. But I think that you asked how to make it successful. Regarding political prisoners, a really easy way to make it successful, other than just releasing them, is to activate a proposal that went through Parliament and just died, to replace pre-trial detention with just parole or probation.
Probation as in they would spend the night in their police station?
No, as in like just house arrest, more or less. Or just don't leave the country.
You have to be the chief of staff of the military for that. Or a former minister of aviation.
Yeah, more or less. But like, it's not a novel concept. Like all the people who get released on fake news charges, because those aren't a thing anymore, they all get released on probation. So you know how to do it.
Mm. But also, even when it comes to that, the scale is, it's not as big of a scale as you make it sound. Like, ever since he called for the reactivated the Prestige Pardon Committee and called for the national dialogue, again, I feel like I'm repeating myself. Only 236 people were released, and I think a huge number of them were not even charged. Like, they were just released on bail. I think their trials are still ongoing. An important thing to note is that these 200 people, they are not the unknown. They are not like just ordinary people. They are either activists, party members, legitimate party members, very well known within the Egyptian political sphere. Some of them were even on hunger strike, like Mokka and so forth. So it's really uneasy, if you may. Like it's as if like they wanna like paint a picture, but not necessarily actually open up space. You get what I mean?
I think the issue is, again, they don't seem to know what to do next. Like when they announced the pardon committee, they released the bulk of those 200 within like a week. And then they started releasing so few that one day he released like four people. They don't seem to know where to go. And in some cases, it seems like the committee itself is the problem. Like they keep going on the media and saying that they won't release anyone whose hands have been sullied with blood. They love that line. Same thing with the dialogue, right? Like he mentioned that he wants everyone there, and he ignored my cat. And he sort of insinuated that he wanted the Brotherhood there, and then again, everyone, except I think like the 6th of April movement, who I didn't even know were still a thing. They were the only ones who didn't say the line, "Oh, we're not going to speak with anyone whose hands have been sullied with blood." Right? Like, okay, then why do you accept Sadat's being there? Why do you accept people who have been police generals there? Or is that fine? But anyway, I think the pardon committee doesn't really know what its purpose is at this point, because they released most of the high-profile ones. The other high-profile ones they're probably not going to release, at least not yet, until they feel more secure. But it's most of the ones, like you said, were released from pretrial detention. Like, they weren't even sentenced yet. Or like that Yahya Abdelhadi case, where he was released the day after he was sentenced. Like, he didn't even get to go to prison. It just seems like they're really not sure what to do. Like, they did the initial escalation, right, of bringing the pardon committee back. But then it was just a sort of what now moment.
And they 2 days ago they released the board of trustees that are gonna facilitate the national dialogue. Have you had a chance to look at it, like the names of the people?
Yeah, it's generally pretty good, apart from like a couple of exceptions. Like they have a guy from the Ahram Center there. If anyone who doesn't know, the Ahram Center is the government's biggest think tank. Like, why is he there? Don't get me wrong, the guy they got from the Alam Center, he's a good writer. He knows what he's doing. But why would you include one of the government's brain trusts in a dialogue with a bunch of parties, right? The only other one that stood out to me was like a random businessman.
Yeah, I found that.
I guess. I thought maybe he's there for the right-wing parties to have someone to talk to.
He probably paid for it.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe he's bringing like the refreshments.
Andy, before we started recording, we were talking about the mechanics and the dynamics of the dialogue itself. Who's going to be there? Is the S-man going to be present? So what do you think? Is he going to be present?
Honestly, I mentioned this to you before, but the way he talks about the dialogue, it's sort of like when you don't want to be at your friend's party, but you don't want to tell him that you don't want to go. He's being very non-committal about it. And the whole political dialogue, everyone involved in running it is very non-committal about what it actually is. The mechanics of how it will work, it's still unclear. Like, is there going to be a talking stick? Are they just going to argue the whole time? And the Ahram Center themselves, for the record, said that they don't want more than 100 participants, I think. It's either 100 or 500, I can't remember. Yeah, because they wanted people to have time to speak. But then the very next day, it was 100. The organizers of the dialogue said that they invited 400 parties. And again, it's like the different organs of the state aren't really in communication sometimes. Or they maybe have different priorities. Like when the Ahram Center said that they wanted only 100 participants, they wanted like the cream of the crop. Like, don't invite everyone from a party, just invite the party heads. Don't invite the little parties that don't matter, that kind of thing. Whereas the dialogue seems to want everyone, except the Brotherhood. But in another case, it's everyone. They even invited people who don't want to be there, like Assam Hengi, who they insisted that he's going to be there. And even he was noncommittal, by the way. He didn't say, I'm not going to be there. He just said, it'll be fine either way. Which, like, it all has a feeling of, how do I put this? It all has that feeling you get when you're trying to organize an outing, but nobody really wants to go.
Yeah, and also when you're talking about whether the S-man is going to eventually show up there or not. I told you about this Vice documentary where a filming crew and like a five or six like NBA players went to Pyongyang to like play a friendly match with the North Korean team. And then towards the end, Kim Jong-un shows up and throws a party for them, like has some pain with them. So I think that's probably the most likely scenario, the Pyongyang scenario.
I mean, maybe he has a real knack for just showing up. Like, he shows up unannounced to a lot of things.
Yeah, I think mainly churches. All right.
Maybe. He also, I don't know if you saw this. I think this was late last year or early this year. He just randomly showed up to a party conference. Like while they were holding a party election, he just randomly showed up.
Do you remember what party was it?
I think it was the Nation's Future Party during their conference, I think in Sharm el-Sheikh or something. Just imagine the president showing up randomly. Just unannounced. In a way, it's sort of like the family dinner, right? It's a flex. It's showing them that I'm not afraid of you guys anymore. You're not.
No, but the Future of a Nation Party, Mustaqbal Watan Party, that's not a threat. That's that's his
bizarre. Oh, that's literally like the intelligence party. But like with the family dinner, right, where he invited more or less all of his enemies. Like that, it's sort of like the when Muhammad Ali invited the Mamluks over. It's just like, you don't matter to me anymore. It's like the dream of any opposition is always to be Navalny, right? You want to be the person who the state fears so much that they try to imprison and poison and exile, right? You never want to be Sabahi. You don't want to be the guy who the state you hate tries to embrace you. But I mean, that's just how modern states work. When they get really secure, when they feel like they're not unsafe anymore, if you want to see what a state feels like when it feels threatened, from 2014 to 2017, that's what a state looks like when it feels threatened. But now this is just how states function when they don't feel like they're about to fall at any point. You start to see an opening up of freedoms, but at the same time, the freedoms can't matter as much. It's like, I can't remember who said this quote, but I think it was a civil rights leader in the US, where they said if voting mattered, they'd make it illegal. It's that kind of thing where you get avenues to express yourself, but it's more just to let things out, right? Just let it out. Don't bother us. And if it matters, you won't be able to do it anymore.
I mean, I wish I shared the same point of view as you, but I think it's quite false that they're opening up spaces of freedom and allowing people to express themselves more. Because then again, they're still persecuting non-combatants before the SSB for the, quote, the package of, like, spreading false information, fake news, belonging to a terrorist organization. That hasn't stopped, and it's still being actively used against non-combatants. And by non-combatants, I mean just ordinary civilians just expressing themselves, retweeting stuff, creating or sharing a meme, a funny meme, and I think there were even like that we know of, you know, the choice, the Ikhtiar, where they had Yasser Gelal play the president. As far as I know, two people were arrested for making fun of the show. You know, as a state or as a person, how, in what way does that make you feel threatened?
Well, the thing is, well, one thing though is that the state security courts aren't accepting new cases. They've taken it more to the regular criminal courts, which is why you see more fake news cases just end. Like, they just give them probation and just end it. Because the reason they charge this kind of stuff is more for the image of the state, right? Like, that, there's no real word for it that's a strong in English, but
yeah,
like
the prestige of the state.
Right. Yeah, I guess. And it's a lot of the time. And the paper I was writing mentions this as well. It's not even the state doing it sometimes. Like, sometimes lawyers will take it upon themselves to sue people because they feel like they demean the state. It's like, remember in the 2018 election when Sisi was running more or less unopposed to the point that even he was embarrassed, and people kept putting up ads for him when he even asked them to stop putting up ads? It's that kind of thing where they want to curry favor with the state so badly that they'll do this. And the state doesn't mind. Like, they can say they mind. They can say that the court backlogs are too large to worry about this kind of thing. They can give people probation for fake news stuff. They can, like they did, remove the emergency law on security courts. But fundamentally, they don't mind when this happens. This crowdsourcing of silence, you know, like if you interact with the state directly, they'll tell you that they love freedom of speech. They'll talk about how they give subsidies to newspapers and all of that, and to an extent they're sincere, because they love most of what that speech is used for. They love when people just talk about random drama and random bullshit, or when they debate like the actions of the state without bringing specifics.
Yeah, and also, I don't want to interrupt you, but
or when they
also that could be extended to like when it comes to political prisoners, because we technically don't have any political prisoners, because they're all charged with kinds of, like, they're charged with either spreading fake news, belonging to a quote terrorist organization, so they aren't technically political prisoners.
Yeah, and funny thing about that too is that even recently the Ministry of Interior said that there are 10 to 15,000 political prisoners. It was the first time I remember them using the phrase political prisoners. But it was specifically with regard to the Pardon Committee. And recently with the Pardon Committee, they've even been releasing prisoners on their own. I think they've released more than the Pardon Committee has. But it's, even though the state wants to project this image, they still really like the idea that people fear them. It's very useful. And you see this with a good example is like South Africa, right? South Africa is a state. It used to have apartheid. and a lot of institutions from apartheid still linger. And even though the state is run by black people now, right, more or less, there's this whole racist thing about it being run by black people and scare quotes. But, you know, whites are not oppressed there. But anyway, even though it's run by them now, the people who are oppressed by apartheid, they still gain from the ethos of apartheid remaining, right? It's useful for a state. It's the same thing with China, right? China really wants to be seen as a state with fundamental freedoms. And to an extent, it's not as bad as portrayed in a lot of media, right? Especially because, like, if a state can be genuinely totalizing in its control, honestly, impressive. Because it's very difficult to control people that much. But it is useful for people to be afraid. It's useful for them to feel like they don't have the rights that they do. Because that takes a lot of burden off of you.
Yeah, but even
it's also...
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's also a trick that they use a lot in Western countries where they'll deploy riot police extremely brutally just to remind you that there are limits to your freedom. But they don't want to say it explicitly. They want it to be something you've internalized without being said. It's violence projection more than anything else. And it's the same reason they switched away from killing dissidents to jailing them. It's sort of like reinforcing a social contract while holding a minigun in your hands. I'm not going to fire it, but this contract is not balanced.
When I interrupted you, I was going to say that if all stays the same for the next decade or possibly two decades, I think the legacy of the Arab Spring, if you want to call it that, or the Egyptian uprising, I think it's going to be like nothing really happened, and even like worse, because they have the media, the state controls the media, and they're changing and have already changed the narrative of the whole thing, 2011, 2012, 2013. Which I think is I think the media plays a really vital role when it comes to political awareness and so forth. And when the media is controlled to that extent, really, like, I don't want to use an inappropriate term, fingered by the state or grabbed by the nuts, it also gives other actors an opportunity to jump in. Like if you realize that Egyptian media that's broadcasting from Cairo, except for this podcast, is directed and funded and like controlled by the state, you're gonna look for alternatives. And one of the like the most notable alternatives that are gonna present themselves and are gonna look more appealing are other sources of information that are equally biased. Like you're gonna seek refuge in the NB's media and like NB funded sources of media. And I think that's equally worrying as well, because there needs to be a median or a medium in which you could actually get independent, unbiased news. Maybe that's too unrealistic to think of. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree with you about the media and it opening doors for people to look elsewhere. But I disagree that the Arab Spring was a failure, that things got worse. I hear that narrative a lot. It makes me wonder where they were under Mubarak, because things were genuinely like far worse. There's one thing to keep in mind is that under Mubarak, things were a lot simpler, mainly because the economy and the state were less complex. But also something like the media, there were fewer newspapers to go around, fewer channels, etc. But they were all controlled by the state, except for Masriyum. They were the one entity that just hung on by the skin of their teeth. Whereas now that they don't have to control all the outlets directly. they can just control a handful and then coerce the rest, which is, again, like, more or less the modernity that people wanted. Like, sorry, this is just how states and media work. If you look in most places, most media, other than state media, just regurgitates press bulletins and press releases. It's only investigative media that get, like, that actually turn through the documents they get and actually looks past the press releases. And you occasionally get that with something like El Mosolium, right? They still exist. They still have their own independence. But the problem is that their capacity to be investigative has been severely decreased, mainly because it's that same fear that I mentioned, right? Like, under Mubarak, the fear was easy. It was easy to get past because you didn't have to do anything to face repercussions. Whereas, again, now there's this sort of threat of a social contract of, like, you can live more or less fine. Like, you'll get by. But if you go out of your lane, there will be consequences. Whereas under Mubarak, people had much less to lose. Like, think back to 2011, right? When did it start? There were riots more or less every month, sometimes every other week.
It was just climax. It wasn't like just something spontaneous.
Exactly. But what was the event that pushed it over the edge? It was removing food subsidies. It literally started 2 days later. Because there was nothing left to lose. Like, if I'm going to die hungry, fuck it. Might as well. If you're going to kill me anyway, then at least kill me before my stomach grumbles. And that was the narrative. Like, there wasn't even regime change on the mind at the time. The first thing that people chanted in the square were people demand prices are lowered. It wasn't even that big a demand. Like, nowadays, you say that kind of thing on Facebook.
Yeah, but I think I kind of disagree with the part that you were saying that under Mubarak it was unpredictable and now it is predictable. I kind of have the complete opposite view on that.
No, it's still, there is still unpredictable stochastic violence. But under Mubarak, it was just background radiation the whole time. Like, there was no rhyme or reason to it. You could just be disappeared for any reason, really.
Yeah, but I mean, of course, that your point of under Mubarak, you could just disappear and never show up again. I think that's a solid point. But also, I think under Mubarak, there were like certain limits, if you want to put it that way, where now there, it's just unpredictable. You can be arrested and not disappeared, but arrested and charged accordingly for doing the most trivial things. You know?
I think the big difference is it's more public now, and it's like a Greek tragedy, right? Whereas before you'd just be shot. Now it's, oh, I sentence you to 16 years going through courts. Right, it's death by bureaucracy. And in a way, it's better because, you know, at least you can still breathe. But, like, publicly, it gets worse, right? It's a worse image where you have someone going through the motions, right? It's more frustrating this way. But also, like, the scale is much different as well.
The, like, scale of repression?
The scale of the repression is much different. But the bigger difference is that the transparency of it is much higher. It's similar to murder, right? It feels like more people get murdered now than they did then, doesn't it? But it's, like, down by a factor of 10 to 15 times. The difference is that now the media, like, swarms around everything. they're extremely bored. They just need something to latch on to, like a story to make the story of the day. So, like, every little murder case I was just saying like so every little murder case becomes like national.
Yeah, because they can't talk about the political, so they only have the social to talk about.
And the thing is, too, even when they talk about the political, it's extremely boring, because the state loves to project this bureaucratic institutional image, right? Like, every project will come through tidbits and press releases over the course of a month. In order to get any info, you have to talk to the press secretary's secretary for communications with media you know, that kind of thing. It's extremely systematized. And if you want to see like a parallel to this, look at like a European country's biggest newspapers. It's boring. It's boring as shit. And that's what they want. That's what they want to emulate. That's their model. It's like, I will bore you to tears until you just do your job.
Yeah, also there's this New Republic, like Gomorek Gedida, which I still don't get what the fuck that means. When does it start? Where is it? It's really
questions. I think what I've gathered is that it's sort of a formalization of that new social contract sort of thing. I was like, okay, the emergency law's gone. We're going to scale things back. No more austerity. You know, social programs are back. That kind of thing. You know, transit is expanding. New cities, blah, 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 right? But when does it start? And did it already start? Are we already in it? What does it mean? Are they going to change the flag? Just very basic questions. But also, it's sort of like they've been tiptoeing around this for a while, where they want to break between the current state and the free officer state. But I'm biased because my minor was Egyptian history, like modern history. I think that we've already had two different republics. I don't think you can really say that the republic we had under Nasser was anything similar to the one we had under Sadat and Mubarak. And I don't think you can say that the republic we have now is the same one we had before 2017 or 2018. These don't behave like the same state. Or maybe it's the same state but has schizophrenia. It's sort of, I guess what they're trying to emulate is like what Charles de Gaulle did, where he divorced the French Republic from the Republic that came before, the one that bowed to the Nazis and all that. And it sort of works. Like you can say that things are different enough that it's a new republic, right? But you have to say what that means. Usually when this stuff happens, they come up with a new constitution or something, but that's not happening. And the constitution itself is already pretty good, honestly. They just have to apply more of it.
You have to activate it. It's already there. I mean, besides the fact that he amended the constitution in 2019 and had this, what I still believe is was a rigged referendum, in which I voted, by the way, and it marked my first political participation. It's due to start in a day or two, the national dialogue. So what they think is ultimately going to come out of the national dialogue? And what do you think what do you think is a more viable alternative to this so-called national dialogue?
Well, for one, I think it's going to be delayed because they still don't have everyone appointed yet. The person running the dialogue is still not appointed yet. But I honestly, like I said, I don't know what the mechanisms will be. We'll have to see. But I think this is really illustrative of the difference between the paradigms we look at this from. Because I don't think the referendum was rigged. And I voted too, by the way. There was a guy in my polling station trying to change my vote last minute. Which is illegal.
How did that happen?
Oh, he was just like trying to convince me. He saw that I was that I went to vote no, and he was trying to convince me to vote yes. And he was talking about the quotas and how now the army can coup the government whenever it wants. And I was like, hey, I mean, you raised some good points, but I already voted. But I don't think they had to rig it, and I think the timing was
No. I didn't mean they rigged it. Sorry, one second. I didn't think they rigged it in terms of it was going to pass or not. I think it's what it was going to ultimately pass anyway. I just think the numbers just don't add up. Go ahead, please.
I mean, think of it from their perspective, right? Yeah. They have the fortune of knowing that most people who disagree won't vote anyway. And that's the beauty of low turnout. It's a thing that they do in local elections in the US too, right? They know that the turnout is going to be really low and that anyone who's against will be too apathetic to vote or just won't have the will in them to vote or won't want to legitimize the election with a vote. So they don't matter anymore. The other thing is, if you think of it from their perspective, they timed it really well. It was in 2019 at the very end of Parliament's term, and legally you can't propose the same constitutional amendments within the same Parliament. So there's no way they lose, because in one turn of events, the election passes, the referendum passes, and they get the amendments they want. Cool. In the other turn of events, it doesn't pass. And they say, hey, look, democracy moment. We wanted to do a thing, you said no, and we let you say no. And then a year later, they propose the same ones again. Maybe with some addendums based on what people didn't like, right? Rephrase some things, add some more concessions, right? So there's no way they lose. And it's similar with a lot of elections where they ensure that either outcome is fine, right? It's also similar to how elections work, for example, in student elections. There's no way that the person you vote for is going to matter enough that they have to rig it. So go ahead, just vote.
Mm. And do you think one of the outcomes that might come out of this national dialogue is more constitution amendments? Because I think that might be a possibility if they really talk. You're muted. Continue.
Sorry, family. Oh, what did you say?
I was saying one of the outcomes that might come out of the national dialogue is that there might be further constitutional amendments. So do you think that's a possibility?
I mean, I think so. Honestly, I think they're waiting for an excuse to amend the constitution because they recently had to do some weird map bullshit because of the capital. Because in the constitution, Cairo is the capital. So they amended the city's borders so that there's a little ring, literally like less than 100 meters in diameter around Parliament, so that technically they're abiding by the constitution. And like, they're probably also waiting to amend it so that they can change certain things like the local election law. It would be easier to pass it as a constitutional amendment than to pass it through Parliament at this point, because the parties all have their own reasons for not passing the local government bill. The problem is that there's election fatigue right now. We just had the House election in the Senate election in 2020, the House election in 2021. Even sports clubs did elections in the past few months. Like, come on. I just think people are tired. And they would want the next referendum to have higher turnout. Like, even though low turnout helps them with referendums, they don't really care how high the turnout is. Just more number is better, because they can't really lose either way. But if they come out with proposals for huge law changes, like maybe they come out with proposals for the personal status bill, if that looks like it's on its way finally after what, 15 years, maybe there'll be amendments for that. Maybe there'll be amendments for the penal code that hasn't changed since the 1930s, you know, that kind of thing. But I really doubt that they ram through constitutional amendments right now. There was a very scary proposal from the Trade Union Federation where they said that one of their core requests of the dialogue will be that the dialogue becomes an annual event. And if that happens, I might just kill myself. Because if it becomes an annual thing, then it's just another conference, right? It's just one of those, like, another Le Marché.
Like the ones he does with the Bedouin.
I mean, at least the Bedouin ones, they started off having a meaning, right? They got a treaty done and everything. And now it's just, let's go drink coffee in the desert together. And that's an issue that happens, right? You run out of things to do. Like at a certain point, there you just hit a wall.
And I was just about to wrap up, but I realized that we didn't talk about why propose a national dialogue in the first place, which is going to eventually lead us to talk about the economy, which has been and is going to shit, really. Inflation is rising. The Egyptian pound is getting even more devalued against the US dollar. And I think that looking at that, it seems like it's key to why he's aiming towards, quote, dialogue, if it's going to turn out to be actual dialogue. So what do you think about that? Do you think it's the economics that eventually led to that?
I think it's a part of it. And I think a part of it too is the budget stuff. I don't know if you're following, but the budget debate this year was a lot more heated than usual. Like, it even included like accusations of corruption, accusations of treason. Like, it goes beyond the regular thing in Parliament where they just throw shoes at each other.
Which was surprising,
right?
Because it's not that like they're all independent. They're all either paid to be there or just there because they proved loyal to the state, you know. So it was quite baffling.
I mean, I wouldn't describe any party as especially hostile to the idea of the state. Not the ones in Parliament anyway. Maybe like at PECAMO, but they're not big enough to be an issue. Social Democratic Party, that kind of thing.
By the state, I don't mean the state. I mean like the regime, the political regime.
I mean, they're more or less synonymous, especially in the sense of Parliament. But I think part of it was they want to let parties vent about that kind of stuff. Maybe propose changes to how things are done, like to the mechanisms by which we achieve these budgets. Like this year as well, the Ministry of Finance tried doing a public consultation for the budget. The state ownership policy document has a consultation going on right now. Right, like I feel like they want people to co-sign on the stuff, or they at least want to say, hey, we asked, right? And that's part of the economy getting worse. And to be fair, a lot of it is out of their hands. Like, it's just what happens when there's a pandemic and a war and a commodity boom and a supply crisis. But part of it too is poor planning. Like, they could have done what they did with debt sooner. They could have paid off some of that debt sooner, like the central bank did. Or they could have made it more long-term, like they did last year. These are things they could have done sooner. They could have digitized the economy faster, instead of having to like rush to do it haphazardly throughout the pandemic. They could have applied the universal healthcare system faster, which would have saved a lot of money.
And all the
they could have finished transit projects faster. And transit plays a huge role in the economy because people can't do anything productive if they can't get anywhere. They could have invested in the South before the year 2018, when the South apparently began existing. There's just a lot of things they could have done to preempt this. And again, it all boils down to I don't think they know where to go from here. Like, I don't think they have a clear idea like they did before. Like, they had an idea of like, this is how the transition will go, and by this point in the transition is over. But I don't think they even planned on reaching this point. I don't think they banked on it being stable enough to reach this point. So, and again, like, it's either going to be really important, and what they come out of the dialogue with will be crucial to how the next 10 years go, or it's just going to be another conference. I have the same view of like the climate conference coming up. Like, it's either going to be one of the most important ones, or it's just not going to be memorable at all. There's no in between.
Any concluding remarks before we wrap up?
I just want to say, if the new republic includes, or the national dialogue includes, changing the flag, honestly, maybe we could have a referendum for that too. Just let's just vote every 3 months.
Yeah, I just reiterate the three or two points that I've been just spewing out for the last 40 minutes. Release non-combatants. Stop persecuting non-combatants for political reasons. You can keep in jail people that wanted to declare fucking caliphate, but otherwise release people, release civilians that shouldn't be there in the first place. Activate the constitution, which is perfectly quite healthy when it comes to personal freedoms and political freedoms and so forth. And again, stop persecuting non-combatants that before the SSP. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next Thursday.